Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast today is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong RegTech Lab, as well as HKU and Standard Chartered Foundation's FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and HKU edX's Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from HKU's Faculty of Law. Our guest today is Lisa Nestor. She's a Los Angeles-based FinTech expert and a pioneer in the field of electronic payments. She currently serves as the Chief Strategy Officer at AirTM. Under her watch, AirTM has successfully facilitated over 26 million transactions and expanded access to commerce and international businesses, both large and small, creating a user-friendly tool benefiting millions of people worldwide. Lisa is passionate about innovation, implementation, and strategy within the shifting fintech landscape, and her knowledge is much sought after by entrepreneurs, developers, and C-suite executives. And with that, Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ajay. This is a great opportunity. Excited to be here.
Likewise, thank you for coming. You're based in LA, but where were you originally from, and where'd you grow up, and how'd you end up in this line of work?
I am originally from North Carolina.
Okay.
And grew up there. Went to undergraduate there, Appalachian State University. And then when I was 21, I took my first leap outside of North Carolina and joined the United States Peace Corps, where I was a small business development volunteer based in Mauritania, West Africa. That's a two-year program where you're placed as a U.S. citizen in another country and you do service in a specific field. And it was a big opportunity for me and really my first exposure to financial inclusion, in that position, rural banking. Thinking about economics and money and kind of how that impacts people. From there, I was able to take a role at the Center for Microfinance, which is based in India, and for 3 years worked with a number of professors from a variety of universities, leading research studies that evaluated different types of financial inclusion, kind of interventions or products specifically designed for the underbanked. And kind of tried to evaluate the impact of those new types of products. Again, an amazing experience. And then jumped to UCLA. That's how I ended up in Los Angeles. I got my Master's of Business Administration there and then formally joined the fintech sector. After about a year in fintech, I was introduced by a UCLA professor to Jed McCaleb, who's kind of an early pioneer in the blockchain space and who was then the CEO of the Stellar Development Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation that supports the Stellar Ledger, which is an open, decentralized blockchain ledger really focused on payments and providing open financial infrastructure. So I was there for 5.5 years where I focused on partnerships and then ecosystem development, which was a really cool new area of work. And then from there, transitioned to AirTM. What's cool is that AirTM actually leverages the Stellar Ledger. So I kind of moved up the stack, so to speak. And it's been a really, really cool experience kind of making that transition and being more in an operational role out of fintech that leverages blockchain. And yeah, I've been at AirTM 2 years and it's been a great journey so far.
There are a lot of firms in the fintech digital payments ecosystem. In that space, what does AirTM do?
AirTM is a digital payments platform that specifically allows individuals and businesses to send and receive digital dollars all over the world. So for individuals or like on the retail side, we provide a digital dollar wallet that connects individuals to hundreds of different types of global payment methods. And then for businesses, we provide more of a payments platform that supports things like mass payouts globally, as well as a payment API that just makes kind of sending and receiving payments within a business's global community super seamless. So those are our products. I guess the thing that I'll add on top of that is that, you know, as a company, we're really kind of focused on supporting what we call the online earning community or digital earning community. And so the businesses and individuals that we serve are kind of focused in that space. And, you know, our kind of belief is that this is a really big growing market where individuals all over the world can kind of get online and access the global dollar economy, which can have a lot of advantages to them. So we focus on connecting businesses and individuals who are in that space and just providing kind of best-in-class payment services for them.
Again, this is an emerging space.
Mm-hmm.
So for firms operating in the fintech crypto space, how do you think they should adjust their business strategies, relatively speaking, to factor in digital money and cross-border payments and, you know, the regulations that go along with it? Because we're in an environment now where people are spoiled for choice. They can go through the banks, or they can go through, you know, money services providers and remittance agencies, or they can avail themselves of, you know, the new methods of payment systems in this age of fintech, and so they're spoiled for choice. And I guess what I'm wondering is, if you are a player and you're in this, you know, operating in this hyper competitive world where people have more choices, how do you shape your strategy, or is your strategy going to be tailored to your niche, and that Western Union's approach is going to be a little different, but others say no, there's going to be a point of convergence, because mm-hmm. ultimately they all will have to deal with traditional fiat currency, but they'll also have to deal with crypto.
You know, you used an interesting word there, which is niche. And I do think that, you know, when we look at the current financial services industry, it is still, you know, quite fragmented, where, you know, you have money service businesses, you have your banks, you have, you know, your crypto wallets or crypto exchanges. But I do think that for the industry, you know, over the next 24, 36 months, we are going to see an increasing demand for digital assets, crypto assets. I think that it's actually going to come from a couple different places, though. So I would say that, you know, I think we're going to see, especially in, we'll say, more kind of like mature economies, a growing demand for more traditional crypto assets, primarily, you know, around the investment opportunity. So you've probably seen a lot of news around the Bitcoin ETF here in the US. I wouldn't be surprised to see other types of things or products like that coming out to market globally. And so I think consumers are going to increasingly demand exposure to these products. And so we may see, you know, more kind of traditional financial services players like stepping in and starting to provide, you know, access to crypto. And so does that start to compete with crypto exchanges? Is there kind of a need anymore for a crypto exchange? You know, I don't think it's something that will happen immediately, but I do think you start to see some convergence there, especially as crypto kind of goes mainstream, right? But I think there's going to be another push that's really driven more by stablecoins, which I think is less, you know, focused on like the US or Europe and much more focused on a lot of emerging economies, which is where AirTM sits and a lot of its business. And, you know, I think there's just going to be a huge demand from consumers to kind of see adoption of this technology, especially by like large players in the field, and just an ability to have to be able to do more with their money, right? In terms of portability, cost of services and those types of things. I think we saw this with PayPal launching its stablecoin at the end of last year, mid last year, which was a huge deal. And I don't think that that was something that they would have necessarily done if they weren't seeing their business being impacted by, a migration of users to stablecoins. And so I guess I think as a business, obviously you can't just go chasing, chasing trends. I do think there's a need to really focus on your use case and what you kind of like the job you fundamentally do for your users and your community. But I do think it's essential that you say, how does crypto or digital assets kind of impact that job that we're doing, right? So, you know, if we're in the payments or cross-border payment space, like what are people wanting to do with stablecoins now? Like, do we need to think about digital wallets as an on and off ramp? Do we need to think about allowing people to, you know, send money through stablecoins? Or as a financial services provider, you know, do I need to start providing crypto as a investment asset for my users? So I would say focus on the job that you do, but it's really important to look at this tech and understand the consumer trends with it.
Because ultimately it's about what is the practical benefit to the consumer? And again, two people may be using the same instrument, but they're looking at it from, it goes back to the three-sided pyramid of what was Bitcoin when it first came out? Is it a payment system? Is it a commodity? Is it a currency? And it's all three, depending on who you are and depending on what you're using it for, what your needs are. So, yeah, that's a point worth retaining. Next issue, which is a perennial concern, and that is the topic of financial inclusion, and that it's something the World Bank and the IMF have been going on about for a good number of years, certainly. Bulk of my career as a financial journalist, and really it kicked into high gear, I'd say, after the global financial crisis in 2008. But more so, it became a topic that you could not avoid at events and conferences from 2010 onwards. And the feeling was, a lot of banks have gotten, lazy and complacent, and that the underlying point was people needed banking services. They didn't necessarily need banks.
There,
telecommunications operators in certain African nations offering banking services on mobile phones. So the topic of financial inclusion and making money easily accessible and immediately available is a critical one. I understand AirTM operates across 190 countries worldwide. How do you manage that array of relationships? And could you tell us about the challenges and triumphs you've experienced operating in so many different jurisdictions and markets?
Firstly, to kind of respond to your comment on financial inclusion, as somebody who's kind of been in that sector for a little while as well, I think it's just important to stress that there's kind of a gradient.
Well, I mean, you remember the pre-digital age because you were in the Peace Corps, right? I mean, you remember when it was a pretty rudimentary, binary analog, cash-driven world.
Oh yeah, I have one of my favorite jokes is the major project I did in the Peace Corps was a rotating savings and lending association in the village I was at with 30 women from our market. And it was the first time I had exposure to a multi-sig account, but it was really just a metal box with three locks and three separate key holders. And so that's how we would kind of secure the money.
Not bare bones.
But it works. And I guess I would just say, that however is kind of an extreme, right? And that is really the, rural, very off kind of off the beaten path user or individual that has very kind of specific needs. But I do think that there's, you know, kind of multiple layers of financial inclusion. And an area that AirTM really focuses is on individuals who have access to the internet, just as a starting point, right? Like, we're not right now building products for, you know, the people who were in my village in Mauritania, although it was so long ago that maybe they're all online now anyways. We need people doing all of that work, right? But I think we really believe that there is an opportunity around financial inclusion in the larger global economy. And kind of the vision we have is, you know, for maybe the last 50, 100 years, we had people who migrated all over the world. And what was the purpose? It was really to access new economies, you know, better economic opportunities. And we think that with technology now and, you know, the kind of prevalence of online work, that there's this new kind of generational shift where you don't necessarily have to move to another country just to be able to kind of access other economic opportunities, right? So we think about those users, and we're very focused on that use case. Internally, we kind of call them a digital entrepreneur, or kind of individuals from all over the world that are, you know, hustlers getting online, looking to make money, whether that's a freelancer or...
The term is digital nomad, that you can tap into economic opportunities and jurisdictions where you'll be paid a higher wage, and you can relocate yourself to a jurisdiction where perhaps the cost of living is lower. But here again, we have to acknowledge that globalization facilitates this, but the rules of globalization are not necessarily fair, because the people who have the opportunity to do that are people with passports from the developed world, from OECD nations.
Yeah.
You know, they have the luxury and the benefit of visa-free access to...
Totally.
You know, set up shop in Bali and derive a U.S. income, but you know, live a, I wouldn't say a third world lifestyle, because Bali isn't that cheap anymore, but a much lower cost of living than, say, one might encounter in LA. Yeah.
Sure, that's totally true. But actually, a major part of our users in AirTM, in fact, I would say most of them, are not what I would classify as a digital nomad or even a freelancer. In fact, our largest kind of work sector at AirTM is what we call taskers. So okay. These are individuals, in fact, one of our kind of core enterprise clients who works with, you know, and kind of pays individuals all over the world through AirTM is a company called Scale AI. And they leverage individuals from all over Africa, Asia, Latin America to help train AI systems. And, you know, oftentimes these are people who maybe are earning $50 a week or something in that range. And it's a great living for them where they're at. And, you know, maybe traditionally for Scale, it was kind of difficult to be able to, you know, make these types of small dollar transfers internationally to such a large global workforce. But now I think with technology and some of these new ways that we're leveraging digital assets, well, I know it's much more affordable. That's what we're doing at AirTM. And so those are the types of jobs that we get really excited about and, you know, want for our community if they want it for themselves, for that to scale to something that maybe does look more like freelancer online work or coding or something like that. But, you know, there's, I think, a growing market of what we call kind of like more tasker-based work,
yeah,
where you're earning much less, and that's a core part of what we do.
I think what you're describing is something akin to, and the author's name eludes me, maybe you remember it, the author of The 4-Hour Week, where basically the view is at that point, you're the entrepreneur. You've got a business you can run remotely from wherever. And you delegate tasks to people in parts where perhaps you don't have to pay as much for labor. And that's how you run your business. And then the question becomes, how do I get payments to those people?
Okay.
Seems like it would seem like in a situation like that, AirTM would fit like a glove then to the needs of that type of entrepreneur. Now, on a related note, I know that you've partnered with 400 unique payment methods, or over 400 unique payment methods. How did you achieve that? I mean, it does beg the question that at a certain point, does the scale not become cumbersome and complicated and weigh you down? I mean, do the complexities of that not just become difficult to deal with, as opposed to if you just focused on a handful of traditional payment methods?
Sure. So, well, I will say certainly having operations across 190 markets will, without a doubt, be complex and always have, you know, issues that arise there. But we, I think, have
Cross-borders, there'll always be complexities. Yeah,
of course. Or just if you're going to, you know, I mean, operating in one country is difficult enough. And if you're operating in 190, then, you know, it's going to be that much more complex. But, you know, we, I think, have a pretty novel approach to how we support local payment rails. So, you know, those payment rails are available through our retail digital wallet. And that wallet, which is a self-custody wallet on the Stellar blockchain, and actually holds USDC, if you're familiar with that stablecoin, is then connected to two different types of payment rails. One type of payment rail is what we call our direct payment integrations. This is an integration that we have with some local kind of payment service provider, who then, you know, gives us access or gives our users access to deposits and withdrawals into local bank accounts or e-wallets. And, you know, those direct payment rails are available in at least, I think, 30 to 50 countries in our network. And we typically work with a company that can support us in multiple countries, right? So that's a way that we're able to achieve some scale there. And it's a great service for our users. They can go from their AirTM wallet and, you know, withdraw to their local bank account through these third-party integrations. However, in addition to that, we also have our own native peer-to-peer marketplace, which allows users to connect with a peer in 190 countries, and exchange their digital dollars on AirTM for local currency. And what's really amazing about this is that it can oftentimes facilitate a local withdrawal, you know, from your AirTM account into a local e-wallet or mobile money wallet, for example, much faster and cheaper than the direct rail, because the users are just able to quickly connect and do these peer-to-peer transfers. And so it also was really useful because it's a way that we're able to kind of launch local rails in a country without having to necessarily do a full integration into some local payment provider. So that's the way we do it. It's a really great way, and I think a really powerful way that we're able to leverage, you know, both stable coins and being able to do peer-to-peer transfers, and also kind of marketplace to help facilitate exchange and price setting there, and create, you know, really robust local on and off ramps for users, especially in markets that can be more difficult to serve.
Take a step back. I mean, it occurs to me, looking at this from a regulatory systems perspective that there is a need for proper cross-border payment infrastructure to support the digital economy in the future. But it begs the question, who will set the rules for this new financial architecture, the industry or nation states? And I mean, we recently had a guest come on saying that Brian Michael, in fact, local economist, saying that Generation Z will have no say in the financial architecture that will undergird their existences in the digital age.
What a dark.
So, yeah. So with that in mind, who will set the rules? Because certain governments certainly seem more eager than others. Yet you do have factions of the industry in different countries saying, you know, it should be more grassroots, upward moving. And I don't know, who will set the standards? Because it seems to me, ultimately, that it's going to lie with governments, because ultimately the sovereign wants to be the one to mint the coin of the realm, and they will be the ones that set down clear parameters.
In my opinion, the way that it should work is that industry should, in a sense, be, you know, leading, kind of creating the game, so to speak, right? Like, this new technology emerges, you know, they should be the one.
Is it a joint thing? Is it a cross collaborative effort to create new rules?
Sure. Well, I guess I would say, if, you know, we're using the game metaphor, industry should be kind of the players on the field and government should be the referees, right? And so it does need to be joint, and there does need to be oversight. But I don't think that kind of building industry around regulations has ever been too successful. Of course, there, you know, when you let industry lead, there maybe is some perceived more risk, because you're kind of allowing things to be created before there's complete certainty about, you know, their risk, for example. But I think that's just the nature of creation. And especially with technology and how fast it continues to move, I actually think it's quite difficult for government to get fully ahead of the ball. It tends to be industry leading. But I would say that you're not mentioning the kind of third player here, who I think optimistically does really matter, which is, you know, the kind of citizen or consumer. And, you know, I think they, I think they influence industry. I think that consumers and users push industry to evolve. I mean, certainly, you know, that's what gets startups to kind of go and chase an opportunity, because they think that there are consumers who will say yes. And kind of going back to the use case I mentioned earlier with PayPal, I mean, you know, that's a huge incumbent player. And for them to innovate and launch their own stablecoin, you know, I don't think that that's something that they would have done without kind of having their hand forced by their user base. So I do think that consumers have an influence here. And ideally, you know, you see industry push. But I also totally acknowledge your point, Ajay, that money is, you know, the underpinning of the nation state. And this industry kind of has a sensitivity to it that maybe other tech industries don't. So, you know, I do think maybe you have a point there, that it's going to be even more a partnership with regulators when we look at kind of new innovation like digital assets or stable coins or CBDC type things.
To come back to your earlier point about how if you left to the industry, that might lead to higher risk, I think that's a point that really does resonate with a lot of people, because in my view, the lesson of 2008 and the subprime crisis and the ensuing global financial meltdown was Wall Street can't regulate itself. That self-regulation all too often means no regulation because of the perverse incentives towards self-dealing and then to benefit one's own firm and one's own sector. I think it did cause a paradigm shift in some people's minds because there were libertarian types that I know in Silicon Valley that were serving the financial sector that it caused them to reevaluate their views on regulation, which were at one point, you know, laissez-faire, let it be, let the market decide. And they came to realize, no, that there do need to be some rules of the road. There does need to be as non-biased an arbiter as possible to enforce those rules where needed, which I think brings us to my next question, which is your thoughts on the utility of decentralized ledgers. Now, this is an interesting topic in the Hong Kong context. Let me tell you why, because there was a time where a lot of the banks were open to the idea of decentralized ledgers. But rather than have an industry-wide decentralized ledger, which the utility of that would be, okay, we could see which institutions were overexposed, which institutions perhaps had too much risk. And, you know, with using the lessons of 2008 as a guide, one could conceivably go to those institutions and say, okay, maybe you've taken on too much leverage, you've taken on too much risk, maybe you need to unwind some of those trades. But they don't want that. They want their own closed circuit decentralized ledger for their own institution. What are your thoughts on how useful decentralized ledgers can be?
I'm a fan. I'm definitely a big fan of decentralized ledgers. I mean, listen, I think it is totally fair to, have some pessimism around financial institutions wanting kind of greater transparency around their, you know, portfolio or their positions or those types of things. And definitely privacy on these ledgers is something that is not totally worked out yet. When I was at Stellar, we worked really closely with IBM for a number of years on, some various kind of banking tech leveraging decentralized ledgers that they, were really pitching to the banks. But there was, a constant concern around privacy. And I think that there are some cohorts or consortiums that you can develop, but it's going to take a while for there to be, we'll say, kind of like radical transparency in that way. That said, I do think that there's kind of two, at least in my mind, really kind of key benefits or innovations with decentralized ledgers that are here today. So one is just the enablement of peer-to-peer instant settlement and just removing the need for third parties in order to settle transactions, assuming both parties will accept digital assets for payment. And then the other is self-custody wallets or just the ability to, as a individual or a business, really hold custody of your own digital money, which I think is important in some places in the world. So, I guess just on the first one, what I would say is there are already companies that are leveraging things like USDC or USDT to instantly settle trade or to instantly settle positions with third parties. And that is, saving a lot of money in terms of or creating a lot of savings in terms of capital efficiency, reducing the need for liquidity, operational efficiency and just speed of transactions. I think it, definitely needs and will continue to grow. But certainly, I think I recently heard there was $11 trillion in stablecoin payments in 2023, a huge portion of that being trade settlement. And so I do think it's a big deal. I think it's something that's already here and creating a lot of value and is only achievable through these decentralized ledgers. And then the self-custody of digital assets, you know, I also think is a big deal. You know, certainly if you talk to people in Lebanon or Argentina who have had direct experience with, third-party custodians, allowing governments or, you know, others to kind of like take money from their accounts. And I think it's a huge innovation for society to now have this ability to hold digital assets, which, you know, is fundamentally how money works today, in the same way that they could keep cash in their pocket or under their mattress. And I think it's going to take a while for that innovation to continue to kind of like percolate and spread in society. But I think it's a really big deal, and it's creating value for people, and actually people who are oftentimes in need of support the most. And it's creating that value now. So, yeah, I think there's still a long way to go for decentralized ledgers to be fully integrated into the banking system formally. But I do think that they're really important and they're not going away.
Are self-custody wallets a solution to digital financial sovereignty? I mean, people seem to think, and on a practical level, people equate that with, okay, well, I'll just carry my coins around in a memory stick in my pocket, and that way I'm safe. And that's not a panacea from a security point of view, but that's for practical purposes, that's how people envisage it oftentimes. And but on a deeper level, the principle level, do self-custody wallets provide people with the means to, with an avenue towards financial sovereignty and independence in an uncertain world?
They certainly provide an avenue. I think they are a solution. I would say the weakness to self-custody wallets, is and always will be the on and off ramps. So at the end of the day, you need to be able to spend your money. And so while you can keep it safe from any third party, yeah, if that safe place doesn't actually let you then spend your money where you need to, then it's only so useful. And that's what I really like about AirTM, what I was very drawn to with the project, because I think, frankly, that the combination of self-custody wallets and peer-to-peer marketplaces are a pretty robust solution for society to ensure, you know, both the on and off ramp and the digital sovereignty. But to answer your question, yes, I do think self-custody wallets are the avenue, but I also think the industry, you know, needs to continue to evolve. I'm a big fan of what I'll call like key recovery solutions that maybe lower the intensity of the self-custody burden for the individual. That's something that AirTM implements, where, you know, users do custody their own keys on their device or through a password. But we have protocols that can be enabled if you lose your device, which allow you to, kind of recover your key through multiple kind of institutions and signers that you work with through KYC to do that. And so I think those types of solutions are really important, along with the on and off ramps, to make self-custody like a really usable thing for most people. But yeah, I think it's a big deal. And I do think that digital financial sovereignty, it's important. I don't think you have to use it, but I think that society is fundamentally worse off if it doesn't exist.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years about stablecoin digital currencies outside of the rubric of national currencies, particularly, again, with those concerned with the watchword that we're using, the term digital financial sovereignty these days. Any thoughts? Are they Are they hoping for too much?
It's going to be interesting. It feels, it feels like there's a couple different real-time experiments going on right now. I think that we are going to see, like, I do think that stablecoin currencies like USDC or Tether or PayPal USD are, what we consider kind of like private stablecoins. They are going to have some friction with some national currencies. Certainly, they're pervasive across emerging markets. And you go to a country like Nigeria, you've got huge stablecoin adoption. And of course, the Nigerian Central Bank is, aware and thinking about these types of things. And, in response, is, very aggressively researching the digital Naira and trying to understand those types of things, as are other countries. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the stablecoin industry evolves. At the same time, we've had e-money wallets around for 20 plus years.
Crypto isn't new. Yeah.
It's not new. Yeah. So, we've had these Payoneer, PayPal, Skrill, like these companies that essentially offer, users in many different countries access to a foreign currency account, right? But I think it's just going to be kind of the pervasiveness and speed of adoption of some of these stable coins in certain countries, and how they start to affect kind of national markets. I think for me, if I start to see governments really leaning into taxation of, revenues and stable coins and that type of thing, where it's kind of like the country is being a bit more, we'll say, open-armed in terms of saying, we'll tax you across a variety of assets, not just, what you're holding in the national currency. I don't know. I think that will show us that we're kind of moving in a different way, but I don't know. I think we have some countries that are leaning very strongly into CBDCs and other countries like the US that are kind of letting the private market take the lead. But I do anticipate there being some friction over the next couple of years, definitely.
On the point of taxation, I mean, I think once the industry is blooming and it's doing, once it's prosperous and it's established, then I think they may decide to impose taxes on it. The push towards taxing the financial sector, taxing interest and dividend income, it's not really caught on in places like Hong Kong, Singapore. Which brings me to my next question, which is, in a really short amount of time, Dubai's really managed to establish itself in the virtual asset space through the creation of the world's first regulator tailored to that market. And so people in that space are flocking to it as we speak. Which part of the world should we look to for developments in this space? And what are your thoughts on the progress Dubai has made?
When I was at Stellar, I got to visit Dubai and Abu Dhabi several times and absolutely acknowledge your point that the regulators there are very ahead of the curve. And I think they've been able to really nurture a thriving ecosystem there. And certainly, those are also regions that are hotspots for cross-border payments. I don't think that's totally a coincidence that they're leaning into this new sector. There's a lot of innovation there. I think my opinion is I kind of put countries to watch into three categories. I think you have the kind of top-down leaders, the kind of countries with governments and regulators who are innovators, and that would certainly be the UAE. I think Singapore has also been doing a lot in this regard. And I think that some kind of more traditional countries like Switzerland, for example, they're kind of leaning in and trying to think about how they can innovate as regulators to attract innovation in their markets. Then I would say I think there's kind of like the bottom-up regulators who are going to have to do things out of necessity. These are places like Argentina, Nigeria. I'd also throw India into that group, where maybe for a number of reasons, just, you know, because of legacy currency issues or just because of, you know, maybe like the type of workforce and the adoption that you're just seeing in country, they're going to be, they're also going to be quick movers. And, you know, I think anytime you see, you know, governments regulating, it's a great opportunity to understand how things work or don't work or kind of how it's, you know, industry responds to it. So I think those countries where we're just seeing huge amounts of kind of bottom-up adoption of digital assets are also places to keep an eye on. And then, of course, I think you just by default have to keep an eye on all of the countries that have the major global currencies. I think, you know, of course, that's the US, Europe, China. They are slower, but the impact of any one of their moves is huge, right? So, yeah, I would say that that's kind of how I think about it and who I would be keeping an eye on.
I guess, in a sense, the developing world, I mean, does fintech, in a sense, give them a chance to catch up in that they don't really necessarily have to reinvent the wheel? They just have to adopt. Well, it gives them a sense, in the sense they're able to leapfrog several generations, several iterations of technology to come up to par.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a yes, but it's also kind of like a complex yes, especially if we're thinking about like blockchain and digital assets. But, you know, absolutely. And, you know, you're seeing some countries take like big swings at that. I'm thinking specifically about like El Salvador and their kind of very aggressive adoption of Bitcoin, you know, which in my mind, among other things, is a way to kind of, you know, take a bet on that economy and ecosystem growing and, you know, kind of change their position in the global power structure, maybe. This technology is going to allow countries to kind of rapidly develop on next generation financial infrastructure and to more quickly, you know, maybe access or move into the global economy and marketplace. But I say it's complex because, you know, going back to your points around currency and nation states, it's also, in some sense, growing the dominance of some of the, you know, major currencies, which can make it even more difficult for emerging economies. So, you know, for a country like, I don't know, Liberia or, you know, Thailand, you know, does a digital renminbi or, you know, USDT tripling every year in terms of its volume, like how does that impact their economy? I think that it may help gain a lot of efficiency. It may have a lot of benefits to individuals, but I do think that it also presents some complexities to how money works globally. So I don't know, not a perfect answer, but I guess it's the best one I can give you.
It also strikes me that even in the developed world, if a party were to accept payment in crypto, going to your point about the on-ramps, the off-ramps, at some point you do need to integrate with the mainstream financial system. That is to say that at some point you will need to convert some of your crypto or virtual assets into fiat currency to, you know, pay for the necessities of life. Yeah. And in that instance, because their domestic currencies oftentimes in Argentina, you know, parts of Africa, Lebanon, even India. That nation's currency isn't necessarily the best store of value. They're gonna revert to converting it into, you know, dollars or pounds or euros or what have you. And so that underscores that even going into the future, yes, other currencies have come up. There are other ways to transact and to save and to speculate. But the hard currencies of the developed world still have a place.
Mm-hmm.
That is the lowest common denominator. That is the mode of payment that is still universally accepted. So this new age of crypto is that doesn't seem to be doing away with the dollar and the OECD currencies. It's just another layer, another veneer on top of that, it would seem to me.
I guess I would say that when the internet came about, it through its sharing of knowledge and information, you know, did make certain languages even more dominant globally, right? Suddenly it was easier for people to get access to English entertainment, American entertainment. And so that didn't mean that, you know, local languages went away, but it increased the dominance of certain languages that were already popular, right? And so I think we're going to see something similar with currencies. Now, the complexity there is that, you know, as you kind of mentioned, there can be a bit of a downward spiral where, you know, if you keep having reduced demand for your currency, then it can weaken that currency and that can become an issue for a country. So I guess I think that's an area that will be a bit complex. But, you know, I think the major currencies are by no means going to go away. I think digital assets and decentralized ledgers may, in fact, make them easier to access for everyone globally. But this is also why I'm personally a fan of and excited about Bitcoin, because I do think that having a non-sovereign digital asset as a player on the field is great for society and maybe really great and important for emerging economies. Because if there is going to be this kind of, we'll say, convergence on certain global currencies, and, you know, maybe the world we live in right now with 200 plus, you know, local currencies may start to change. Yeah, I think having kind of an apolitical global currency could be really good.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that, especially when the issuer, the world's currency, is the largest debtor nation. But then people are like, well, is it really an issue? Because most of the debt that the U.S. owes to itself. So, yeah, these arguments can go on forever. But in the time we've got left, what have been your experiences, and what do you see as can be done to get more women into that field? I mean, because there's no one conventional route, and indeed, there are a lot of non-techies in your space.
Yeah, I would say definitely my experience in tech and in the crypto space, you know, has seen many more men than women. Although I will say I've had the pleasure of meeting and working with a lot of really great women leaders. For example, Danelle Dixon, who's CEO of the Stellar Development Foundation, previously COO of Mozilla. So
And
she's one of many, but, you know, I guess I would say, you know, seeing someone like that certainly makes it much easier for you to imagine yourself, you know, as you can continue to grow through your career. But, you know, I think to your point, like, here's the deal. There's kind of layers of stuff here, like tech. You know, fundamentally, a lot of tech is driven by developers, By folks that are more, from the technical engineering side. And those have traditionally been, more male culture industries. So I think on the educational side, it's great to be investing in, early on coding and community, even just like schools and brands that can appeal to women or just different cultures of people outside of maybe the traditional, developer culture that we saw in Silicon Valley that was very male oriented. But to your point, I also think sometimes people have the wrong impression about tech and the type of jobs that they get in tech. And I can tell you that when I joined Stellar, it was a team of engineers, and they hired me because I wasn't an engineer. And my job was to really be a translator between the world and business decision makers and this team of engineers, and to really focus on explaining, what the technology could do and words that were meaningful to people who weren't technical. And I think that there are many types of roles like that in the tech industry where people with a variety of skill sets are incredibly valuable. And especially in an industry like digital assets and blockchain, those are the jobs that are really growing the industry right now. Of course, we're going to continue to innovate on the technical layer, but right now it's really about adoption and communication. Just helping to kind of grow the top line of the market. So, yeah, I think it's great to continue to see diversity, and I think it kind of gets tackled a couple different ways. Certainly, I would say that if you are a woman and you're interested in this field, there is absolutely a path for you. And whether that's technical or non-technical, and don't doubt yourself, because many times the missing ingredient is that non-technical person who can really help to elevate the business.
Your point about the need for translators and communicators is spot on, because what I've seen, if I were to draw an analogy to the consulting space, is that something I did for a brief period of time early in my career was there were people that could run the models, that could create the models, that could do the math, and then there were those that could explain what it meant. And from what I could tell, the people whose careers had an incredible trajectory were those that could explain what it meant. Because nowadays in investment banking and consulting, a lot of it is spreadsheets. A lot of it is knowing what to plug into which cell. And so the people who are great communicators, those are the ones that do better in their careers. So, yeah, that's a very valid point. And if you were to address our students more broadly, I mean, we are law schools, so that is my background too. So I do come at things from the perspective of financial regulation. It seems to me that the financial lawyer of the future will have to straddle both tech and finance and rules and regs, but especially tech. They'll need to come up to speed on that. Again, such a backdrop. I mean, what is there anything you'd say to our graduates as they make their way in the world in a world where it seems to be perpetual learning, particularly about technology, is going to be a must?
Yeah, learn about the tech, learn about the industry, spend time with operators in the industry. Obviously, all of that's important. I guess maybe what's like a little bit more unconventional is I think I personally have had success, and I've seen others have success when, you approach any job or any project with really an owner's mentality. And of course, your training or your specialty may be legal, but I think if you also, when you're at a company, you know, look at it more holistically from a business vantage point and, you know, just try not to think in such maybe isolated terms or just project by project, but really think bigger picture about the business, be curious about where the business is really trying to go, you know, what makes money for the business, these types of things. And then if you kind of combine that curiosity with an ability to apply a legal lens and think strategically, like you'll be unstoppable. So yeah, I guess I would just encourage like really feeling like you can be more than like your title and really think critically about the business. And I guess just in addition to that, I would say that, you know, right now, what technology is doing to money is changing fundamentally a lot of things about how money works in society. And I think as much as we do need to be open to, you know, regulators and listen to their guidance around, you know, what, like, you know, what's appropriate to do, I also think that it is up to leaders in business and also just citizen leaders to be thinking critically about, you know, how this type of new technology, you know, enables certain types of businesses or, you know, fundamentally changes rights or capabilities for citizens. And I think this is an incredibly exciting space. You know, the whole discussion we had about national currencies and stable coins and, you know, fundamentally, is there a right to digital sovereignty? These types of questions, I think we're really going to be asking over the next 50 years. So if that's an area of interest for you, I would just encourage people to, you know, lean into also being a thought leader. And kind of asking some of those deeper questions about what this technology enables.
When you got your MBA at the Anderson School of Management at the UCLA, I mean, maybe it's difficult to narrow it down to just one thing, but if I could push you on that, what was the most important thing you felt you learned or gained from that experience? I mean, what key set of skills or toolkit did it leave you with? That serves you well now?
I do think that having exposure to many different fields during that time period gave me a level of confidence as a business leader. So, you know, but that's kind of more of the surface level thing. I would say that the two really important things for me, one is it forced me to really own my own narrative as a business leader and kind of think critically about, you know, how I build my own strategy, no matter where I am. And, you know, the manifestation of that was, you know, in business school, you oftentimes have to do these like 30-second pitches about yourself, where you're like 2-minute pitch about yourself. And it's really quite an anxiety-inducing experience because, you know, you're trying to like basically brand yourself and position yourself in front of a recruiter's eyes. And frankly, I was pretty horrible at it for the first year. You know, then kind of eventually had a career counselor just sit me down and be like, listen, like you need to like sell your own story and really kind of think about how you're presenting yourself and positioning yourself. And I guess it was just such, it really just made me think about my, you know, strategy on this very fundamental personal level. You know, how am I telling my story? Who is the audience? Like, what's going on here? And then, you know, I've been able to take that skill and just kind of rinse and repeat, but sometimes more, you know, at a company level or at a team level. So yeah, I think it was really beneficial for me in that way. And then, you know, the connections that I made, that have continued to kind of pay off in spades. And as I mentioned, I became friends with a finance professor when I was at UCLA Anderson. His name's Bhagwan Chowdhury. And he was also very passionate about financial inclusion. And we, you know, just worked on various research projects together while we were there. And he's eventually who connected me into the blockchain space when I had zero experience. And I think business school is really about those connections and learning how to leverage your network as a productive asset. I think it's really important. It's a killer skill if you can develop it. So I'd say those two things.
In the time we've got left, and I want to be respectful of your time, is there anything you feel we didn't discuss? Anything you'd like to impress on our audience?
No, I think this has been a great discussion. You know, I would just say it's a very exciting field, digital assets in the fintech space right now. So if it's an area you're exploring, good for you. And, you know, certainly I'll say you can find more information about Airtm online at airtm.com. And I am on Twitter, where I do like to do some writing from time to time. I'm currently working on a stablecoin ebook. So you can find me. Yeah, we'll see. But it's Nestorius828. And, you know, always excited to hear from other people. And so, yeah, that's all I'll say. But it's been a pleasure, Ajay. I thought these were really great questions and discussions.
Again, Lisa, thank you so much for your time. And to our audience, thank you. Until next time.